Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Complaints.
10,000 people.
Look, Andrew Sachs, I've got respect for you and your lineage and progeny. Never let that be questioned.
Don't hint.
I wasn't hinting. Why did that come across as a hint?
Because you know what you're talking about.
That wasn't a hint. Now, when you were
he fucked your granddaughter.
Ofcom.
BBC guidelines.
Where is the Director General, Mark Thompson?
Who gave permission for that broadcast to go out?
I think they should be punished. I think they should have their jobs taken away.
Completely unacceptable.
18,000 complaints. Pre-recorded programme.
Gross lapse of taste.
Severe offence.
He said, would you like to do the whole thing again next week if you're free? I said, that's a good idea.
Sorry, Mr. Sachs, I'm afraid we're going to have to deal with this right now. As Manuel Gate engulfs the BBC in the biggest crisis since Hutton, we've got the definitive view on the only story in town. We'll have the fallout from the F-words as the BBC gets yet another battering from the media led by the Mail. Leslie Douglas and Russell Brand have paid for a puerile prank with their jobs, and Jonathan Ross's Radio 2 ambitions are in tatters. We hear from former BBC insider Liz Forgan, top cultural columnist John Harris, and our own team of insightful commentators. Welcome to Media Talk from The Guardian. Let me get a few things out of the way first. There was a clamour on the Facebook page for a special edition, but this is not a 24-hour news network. We wanted to wait for the dust to settle first, and there was an equal clamour not to mention it at all. Sorry, you lot can turn off now and come back next week, because we've only got one topic on the podcast this week. To discuss it, we have an esteemed panel. Janine Gibson is the editor-in-chief of Media Guardian, and Emily Bell is our director of digital content. Before we go any further, do you, either of you have any special relationship to declare with Russell Brand?
No. No, I do. I've got a sort of a picture of him on my office wall, but only because it's a tasteful piece of photography from The Guardian.
No, it's not. You love him.
No, I don't. I love my husband, but I'm an admirer of his work. But
excellent.
However, I've seen what can happen to people like Leslie Douglas who get a bit too close.
Well, it is a salutary lesson for you.
It is.
All right. Well, listen, let's get on to it. After a tumultuous week, Leslie Douglas has quit as controller of Radio 2. She followed her protege, Russell Brand, out of the door. Jonathan Ross has been suspended, but the BBC balked at the idea of getting rid of him too. Is it enough to save the BBC from the jaws of the Daily Mail, or has the corporation been cowed by the combined forces of the media hunting in a savaging pack? How did it come to this? To understand this a bit better, let's go back to the beginning. Now, we've just heard part of the call to Andrew Sachs that started the controversy, but this was followed by a series of answer phone messages. Here's the second call that Brand and Ross made in the programme that was broadcast on Radio 2 on October the 18th.
Hello, Manuel here.
Right, sorry, I can't answer at the moment. But
I'm too busy thinking about killing myself because of the harsh truths of my daughter's social life. Right.
When you've left just your message,
we all know that. Why do they bother with that bit these days? It's a waste of our time listening to that bit. Andrew, this is Russell Brand. I'm so sorry about the last message. It was part of the radio show. It was a mistake.
Just a joke. If there is any truth in that, I don't know. It was just a joke.
And it was Russell, just a joke,
Russell
basically.
Asked me to say it as a joke.
Look, Andrew, I'm phoning you to ask if I can marry. That's right, marry your granddaughter, Georgina the granddaughter.
And I'd like to be a page boy.
He wants to be a page boy. We're going to have a Fawlty Towers themed wedding.
No, now you've spoiled it.
No, that's why I made you better. Oh, look, I'm sorry, I'll do anything. I wore a condom. Put the phone down.
Now, the pair continued their prank with a further call in which they say sing an apology to the 78-year-old actor.
Your granddaughter.
That's bad.
Sorry, I can't answer at the moment.
Right, there
please call again.
She was bent over the couch.
Thank you.
Ba-ba-ba-boo.
I'd like to apologise for these terrible attacks, Andrew Sachs. I'd like to show contrition to the max, Andrew Sachs. I'd like to create world peace between the yellow, whites and blacks, Andrew Sachs. Andrew Sachs. I said some things I didn't have oughta, like I had sex with your granddaughter. But it was consensual, and she wasn't menstrual. It was consensual, lovely sex.
So the thing is, I mean, that's not the worst of it, to be quite honest. So the question that needs to be asked: did all that need to end the way it did? Let's look at that angle first. I mean, Janine, you know, by only suspending Jonathan Ross, has the BBC bottled it when it came to the real issue? Because this is all about Jonathan Ross and not Russell Brand, isn't it?
All right, I feel I must say up front, it's a good job you came to me first, because Emily is still rendered helpless by the Wildean wit of Ross and Brand.
No, I'm not. I'm taking it very seriously. I think it's disgraceful.
But this too is part of the point. So a lot of people have got distracted by is it funny or not, which frankly couldn't be less of the point. That's no, you know, that stopped being the point at the moment it was broadcast. And actually whether Russell Brand's role in it again isn't really the point, because what we're looking at here is, I'm afraid, the anatomy of a media scandal drilled up by a newspaper for whom Jonathan Ross, being outrageous, late at night on Radio 2, what with all the money we spend on him, it seems to sum up everything they hate about the world. And it hits so many sweet spots for Associated. And not, it's, you know, it's never bad for News International to kick in to criticising the BBC, so that's how you get traction. But it's so brilliant for them that they were just never going to let it go.
Emily, do you agree that is it a tabloid witch hunt led by the Daily Mail?
Yes. I mean, it is. Let's not forget that Andrew Sachs actually had done the decent, well, not done the decent thing. He'd risen above it. There was no way that he didn't know that this had been recorded. He didn't know it had gone out. But he you know, you've seen him on film saying, actually, and the sequence of events show that he was rung by journalists several days later and made to listen to the tape to be outraged. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about it that this can, as I say, my theory is that because Melanie Phillips's repeat of The Moral Maze is actually scheduled directly against the Russell Brand show on a Saturday night, this is entirely about audience building, and I'm hoping there's going to be an investigation. But I mean, it is so completely disproportionate. And your question about did it have to end like this, I think there are also, it's exposed some very serious questions about editorial control and brand values at the BBC. But actually, in itself, it couldn't have been more trivial. And if you think about the last sort of firestorm like this, it was Hutton, which could not have been more serious. And if the BBC is forced to react like this to something which is so utterly trivial...
This is a really interesting point, Janine. Will executives have to resign for every minor infraction that's committed by one of their stars?
Well, it's very interesting. I do think that since Hutton, the stakes have really raised. Because Hutton, obviously...
The resignation stakes.
Yeah, exactly. But also the sort of how the BBC has to react to a problem has become a sort of this level of abasement that's quite strong. Although this is a relatively trivial thing compared to, say, were there weapons of mass destruction in Iraq,
it's completely trivial.
No, they shouldn't have done it.
No,
there's no bit that
not.
Goes, oh, no, that was completely fine.
No.
So, you know, there is the infringement of programme codes, and a producer was out of line and probably should have been disciplined and all the rest of it. Everybody, we all agree that the reaction is completely disproportionate. But the real problem here is that the BBC has no idea how to be able to take a measured response. Mark Thompson apparently goes on holiday for 4 days and nobody reads the papers. I don't really understand how that happens.
I think this is really an interesting thing as well about the media society that we're living in, which is how quickly things can escalate, and actually how people, you know, the BBC ironically has rather encouraged the joining in society, you know, the red button culture, and people actually now quite like to be part of a story. So people who are ringing up and registering complaints 2 days ago actually weren't feeling, when, you know, it's interesting, Michael Lyons was saying this morning, you know, the scale of public outrage. There isn't a scale of public outrage. There are a number of people who've got very excited about it over an extremely short period of time, feel that they can have an opinion which registers, but it's not, you know, a profound moral issue.
But there is definitely a scale of public interest, because this story is going, you know, the reason that it's being...
It's top of the
search terms, it's our most read stories on the website, there's a huge interest.
And actually there is public outrage, but what the outrage is about isn't really, it's not really about... Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross even saying rude things about National Treasure Andrew Sachs on Radio 2. That's part of it. It's really about Jonathan Ross, who we pay £18 million a year, and a sense that somehow this metropolitan media elite can get away with being sneery and being above the law because they are paid all this money. They can be, you know, because they think they're funny. And I do, there is something in that.
I don't disagree with that. I think that's true, that there is a zeitgeist here about the disconnect between how one set of people live and how, what the reality for everybody else is, which I think is a lightning rod for people's anger.
And we can say all the time, if you don't like Jonathan Ross, don't listen to it. And the vast majority of people don't listen to Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand because they don't like it. But if it's sort of thrust upon you, then suddenly Russell Brand's style of humour can feel quite shocking.
We'll pick apart more of the issues in a moment. Richard Littlejohn, a stunning victory over self-appointed, self-obsessed, metropolitan narcissists who control so much of our public life. That's us, I think. This does seem to be a...
It's always good to know where you stand by reading Littlejohn.
This does seem to be a peculiarly BBC kind of story. Why does this sort of thing keep happening to the corporation? I turned to someone who knew it intimately. Liz Forgan, now the chair of the Scott Trust Limited, which controls The Guardian, is a former managing director of BBC Radio. She was there when Chris Evans was at his zaniest. What did she think went wrong this time?
I think, looking at it, what went wrong is not that the processes were not in place. The BBC is full of processes. What went wrong is a matter of human judgment. Somebody looked at that programme and thought it was the right thing to transmit on the BBC. And that's a matter of the ethos and culture of the organisation.
So that's not something that you can legislate against with producer guidelines then, isn't it? So all these people who are clamouring for the rules to be tightened up, that's not the issue to address.
Well, every time something like this happens, there's a clamour for the rules to be tightened up and a great song and dance has gone through and someone declares that the rules have indeed been tightened up and many more rules are written and it doesn't actually make any difference. The problem is twofold. One is the power of really hot entertainment stars. And that has changed as the years have gone on and as the proliferation of channels has hotted up the competition for those talents. The ability to control them is getting harder and harder. But one of the jobs of BBC producers is to identify talent and develop it and encourage it. But another part of their job is to know when to stop it. And I think that didn't happen here.
And perhaps that's something that is part of a general culture and that needs to be addressed. The problem is, I guess, is if you pay talent so much money, the more you pay them, the more difficult it gets to control them, paradoxically.
That's, of course, right. And, you know, telling somebody of the power and profile of Jonathan Ross or Russell Brand that you're not going to transmit what they're saying is a very hard thing to ask a young person who's probably earning a 20th of what they're earning to do. It's not an easy matter. But that's why the BBC has elaborate systems for referring upwards and upwards and upwards and upwards. And, you know, you can't get away from the fact here that somebody, apparently, at a relatively senior level, thought this was right to transmit on the BBC. So why is it that a considered judgment by a relatively senior editorial figure, we hear, made that wrong judgment call? And I'm afraid that it's about a change in the way the BBC employs its staff. Once upon a time, people worked for the BBC, person and boy, for years and years and years, and they kind of breathed in the ethos with every day of their lives. Now people are there on contracts of 3-6 months. They come and go. It's a wholly different setup. And I don't think that there are in place proper ways of transmitting that instinct for what an audience will put up with or be frightened and shocked by. You know, this isn't the worst programme that's ever been transmit it. You know, we need to face up to this. Yeah. It's ludicrous having the Prime Minister stopping thinking about the collapse of the world economy and people dying of starvation in Eastern Congo to talk about this. It was ugly, it was revolting, and it was infantile. But it wasn't the end of the world. But it just got badly handled.
And badly handled, rather sluggishly handled. Why does the BBC always seem to take so long to realise the magnitude of things like this?
Well, I think it's a complicated thing. There's a deep resistance, for good reasons, inside the BBC to shopping the talent. You know, there's a deep resistance to censoring talented and popular people, and so there should be. But, you know, there comes a moment when you have to, and somebody should have known that that was the moment. It having not been done, then they were far too slow to apologise. The fact that the Director General's had to come back from his holiday is ludicrous. They can't devolve responsibility. Some idiot in Land's End makes a mistake, and the Director General is held responsible. Mm. You know, it's very hard.
And it's hard to see how that can change. You were there, of course, when Chris Evans was causing trouble at Radio 1, Radio 4, Long Wave, when Middle England marched on Broadcasting House. But no one had to resign then, did they?
Talented entertainers are constantly offending the audience, and so they should. That's part of the nature of inventiveness and creativity. But it's the job of executives at the BBC who are not underpaid to understand when they've gone across a line. You know, they got it wrong this time. But why did it take so long for the organisation at any serious level to recognise that? I think that's a good question.
Did you ever have any recalcitrant presenters hauled into your office to haul them over the coals in your day?
I found myself having interesting conversations with the governors on the subject of Chris Evans very often. And I think, on the whole, I was on Chris Evans' side mostly. But I thought it was my job to go and explain why it was right for Chris Evans to go as close to the line as he went. We never came with Chris to a point where the audience was outraged. I mean, I think it is true to say that there is an element of, you know, BBC baiting in all this. I think the BBC's competitors and opponents thoroughly enjoy stoking up this. It doesn't alter the fact it was a mistake. And I think, you know, the creation of the BBC Trust, which was supposed to make all this work much more smoothly, has not succeeded in doing that. And I don't think that's very surprising.
So Liz Forgan says the Trust is all at fault, but it seems to me, Janine, that there was a massive bust-up at the Trust meeting this week, and it was they who toughened up the BBC's stance.
Do you think? I don't know. I don't know what happened inside the Trust. And, of course, we're talking now Friday morning. We're waiting for the blow-by-blow.
Yeah.
I mean, I do love a good BBC internal inquiry result. Yes. You know, it's almost as good as a ruling on a Heather Mills divorce. There's 264 paragraphs.
Well, apparently.
Who said what to who.
Apparently Michael Lyons called Mark Thompson back from his holiday in Sicily.
Well, quite right.
We read.
No, quite right. You know, Mark Thompson had to come back and handle it. And actually, it is a measure of what Mark Thompson has done consistently over the last 2 years, that when he says this is a proportionate response, you think, well, no, actually, it is a proportionate response, and that's fine. I think there are two things that I'm still slightly obsessed about now. One is the destruction of the BBC's press office, which is a response to cuts and to the, you know, nervousness about the future. But what they did was that they downgraded the head of communications role. I was talking to somebody yesterday who was approached for that job after Sally Osman left. He said the problem was they made it report into Tim Davey. They downgraded it. And at that point, you're not getting that sort of reaction and communications advice, which is
takes back to the same thing that happened last year. The press office, you know, didn't appreciate the scale of the Queen story, did it?
But this comes back to something which is even more profound than that, which is the point that Liz Forgan was raising, which is she used the words, you know, it's the ethos and culture of the organisation. And within the BBC, there is no longer one ethos and culture. There are two. And it's portrayed, somebody from the BBC was saying to me last night, you know, that there is internal war, and they said at Radio 2, but actually I think it's more endemic in the BBC between the old school, who think that there are standards and basically core editorial values.
BBC values.
And that everything, they rule everything. Those are your core brand proposition.
Right. And what's the other one?
Is the reach to audiences at any cost. In other words, you know, it doesn't matter that you pay Jonathan Ross £18 million because you reach an audience and you have a sort of certain leverage with a segment of the audience that you wouldn't have otherwise. It's the ethos that puts a marketing director in charge of radio. It's the ethos that means that you're professionalising, in inverted commas, management with broader skills which are not core editorial skills. And I think it's profoundly confusing because the BBC doesn't know whether its future is commercial or public service, and it's shot through every single issue that they face, and they've got to get it right. Otherwise, they really don't have a public service future.
You mentioned Tim Davie, the new director of audio and music, and it was Tim Davie that gave the first public comments on this issue by a BBC executive. This is what he had to say.
I personally will be leading an investigation over the next few days. Now, it is absolutely appropriate that we take a bit of time to look at the facts and
do
the investigation.
But surely while you're waiting, something should be done saying, no more, they've crossed a line here.
Well, what we need to make sure, of course, is that any output that comes from the BBC follows our clear editorial guidelines. That's something that I feel strongly at the top of the BBC, and everyone feels absolutely committed to that.
So what do you make of that as a response, Janine?
Oh, God, not since Andy Duncan stood up to try and defend Celebrity Big Brother in his polo shirt has there been
at least Tim was wearing I don't know if there was a tie, but there was definitely a suit involved.
He managed a jacket, and that was the only improvement. It was so completely inadequate and not up to it. And you felt he was shoved out in front of the cameras with the most sort of friendly person in BBC News they could find, which is not easy, I will admit, because at that point you've got 6,000 extremely unhappy journalists going, that bastard deserves everything he gets.
The really interesting thing about that is that he was only allowed him to be interviewed by a BBC journalist, the tape of which they then made available to other broadcasters, who then broadcasted it as labelled BBC video, which I think made the BBC News division sort of culpable and part of the kind of Pravda machine.
See, I think Emily's absolutely right about this, which is that there's something here that's almost intangible. I've never met Tim Davie. I'm sure he's doing a marvellous job at working out what his stations do and all the rest of it. He's only been in the job a few weeks. We can hardly blame it all on him. However, he sat there with absolutely no authority whatsoever in an editorial crisis, didn't he? Yes. Nothing. He couldn't say anything. All he could say was, we're going to have an investigation.
The thing he said was, at this point, it's appropriate to wait.
Yeah.
No, at this point, it's not appropriate to wait. Anyone who heard it and is even glancingly familiar with the producer guidelines would say, this is wrong, we are really sorry, I'm actually going to go away now and decide whose arse to kick and how hard. it's not difficult.
Well, I wonder, this is very interesting, because the judgment of Tim Davie in making the comments that he did has obviously been called into question, and his background has been called into question as well. He doesn't have an editorial background, and just before he was appointed, there was speculation that it would be Tim Davie who would succeed Jenny Abramsky as director of radio. Emily, this is what you said on the Media Talk podcast.
If you're head of radio, you are kind of in charge of quite a lot of the news output. To have somebody with no content creation background at all in that job, you know, Jonathan Ross swearing at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, it's a big ask. And I'm sort of quite surprised.
It's all her fault.
I'm a witch. I am a witch. It's Halloween. But, and you know that thing I said about five national newspapers? Bang, there goes the Daily Mail.
But listen, this is interesting. It's interesting that you picked on Jonathan Ross.
Well, because it's not, again, it's not rocket science. You know that Jonathan Ross sails close to the wind at 10 o'clock in the morning. And you also know that if you've got someone who is too in love with, you know, the audience reach and isn't grounded enough in basically firestorms around sort of content issues, that they're going to be in trouble. Andy Duncan said, you know, the week of the Big Brother racism row, which in some ways was actually much more sort of profoundly serious. He said that was personally a really steep learning curve for him. You know, organisations like the BBC shouldn't be putting senior managers in who have to do learning in public. The news response for a media organisation to respond so poorly.
I don't understand how they could not possibly have learned from the row over the Queen, which was less than a year ago.
I think that there was a slight lack of proportionality about response then. I think that, you know, people were fired who probably shouldn't have been fired. I think there were fundamental issues of trust. But I think the response was, you know, we've clearly got ourselves into a situation where people are making mistakes far too frequently. We're going to really sort of change this. Today, today, Mark Thompson was saying this is a new regime of tighter editorial controls. Hang on a second.
What happened to the old regime?
Yeah, I was going to say, what happened to, the, as you say, the intervening year and just this sort of sense of actually... And I think that there's something about Mark Thompson's management style here.
Is his job on the line now? Because this is too really serious. He's lost Leslie Douglas and he's lost Peter Fincham. I mean, that's really bad.
Seriously, no, stop escalating. Okay. His job is not on the line. Okay. I know I wrote that, but that was a joke.
No, his job is not on the line, but I think there's something,
he's
again...
He's got to be tricky. His judgment is...
I tell you what, which is I think there's an internal issue here, which is that this is about your core brand proposition. You would not put the head of marketing, you know, in charge of the production line for the Golf, for instance. And you wouldn't do that because it's about producing a product which is flawless, even though actually the sale of that product is entirely down to marketing skills. Mm. And, you know, this is core. And I think they've got so confused about this. And that has to be about Thompson's leadership. He needs to get out there and walk the floor and be really sort of interested and engaged in these key editorial issues, because people need to feel the fear a bit more.
Janine.
And one of the things I think is clever about this suspension idea is that we have managed to lower the stakes a bit, because actually
that
since
seems
Hutton,
proportionate.
Yeah, since Hutton, I'm not kidding, there is something about that if a head doesn't roll, if someone doesn't resign, that hasn't been enough. And since Fincham went last year, it was sort of inevitable that Leslie Douglas would have to go this time in the same way.
Okay.
It's a terrible thing that two of the most successful controllers in the nation's sort of cultural fabric have been forced out their jobs.
All right, you mentioned Leslie Douglas. Let's move on to Radio 2 itself. It's Britain's most popular radio station, transformed from the cuddly cardigan channel epitomised by Jimmy Young and Big Band Special to the dynamic network home to Mark Radcliffe, Dermot O'Leary and Chris Evans. All these were brought in by Douglas, and this was how the news was announced on Radio 2, followed by Chris Evans's tearful tribute to her as he left the station after his show on Thursday.
BBC News at 6 o'clock. Good evening, this is Fran Godfrey. The controller of Radio 2, Leslie Douglas, has resigned.
Everybody's a bit down because we all love Leslie so much. Honestly, she's a great boss, you know. She's a great boss. And if the chain of command dictated that she's got to go, then and she decided that was the case, that, which she obviously has, then we can't change that. But honestly, she was a great boss.
Will you want to carry on here?
No, absolutely. Yeah, that would be the last thing she'd want any of us to do. You know, she's spent years making this place what it is. Sounds great. The radio station sounds great.
That was Chris Evans on his way out of Radio 2 headquarters on Thursday. But amongst other presenters, the love for Leslie was not quite as strong, as Paul Cambaccini told Nicky Campbell on BBC Radio 5 Live on Friday morning.
Leslie had a commitment to Russell, which was almost obsessive. That is to say, she believed that his hire was a good move for Radio 2, and she stood by him thick and thin, even while he was alienating almost everybody else in the building.
So I hear he had five or six producers, and whenever one said no to him, he went and got him or her sacked.
You've heard accurately. The result of this was to gut the so-called chain of command. Because he succeeded in becoming an independent production where everybody was answerable only to himself, the chain of command had been reduced to two people, Russell and Leslie.
Paul Gambaccini went on to criticise Leslie Douglas's lack of control over Russell Brand.
You've identified this kind of fatal attraction and this link to Russell Brand. She kind of lost a grip on Russell.
She believed that Russell was an important symbol. But
she let him get away with, you know, far too much? That's basically it, isn't it?
There's no question about it. You know, I can try and be evasive and clever and come up with euphemisms, but the fact is that he was her pet, and she let him get away with so many outrageous things.
Strong stuff there from Paul Gambaccini. With me for this particular segment is our radio correspondent, John Plunkett. That was an extraordinary interview that Paul Gambaccini gave to Five Live, wasn't it?
He didn't hold back, did he? Yes, and I think he was. I think in there is he was representing the feelings of perhaps quite a few people at Radio 2, where I think there was a possibly from people I've spoken to a bit of a split evolving between the old Radio 2 And the new edgier Radio 2, and perhaps the old school DJs were less than happy with what was happening with other parts of the schedule.
And this issue of the chain of command and the lack of editorial control over, well, particularly Russell Brand, but it could extend to other programmes as well, is interesting, because particularly the Russell Brand Show was an independent production.
That's right, yes. It went independent in May this year, I think. It was originally an in-house BBC production, but I think it was Brand that requested the change.
Paul Gambaccini was saying, and Russell Brand's request, it does seem to be that Leslie Douglas did give the head to these stars and did accede to their demands. And that can be quite dangerous, can't it?
Yeah, and I think there was some people within Radio 2 have said to me that they think it's possibly a sort of a vindication of some of the concerns that they had when they saw this lack of control.
Talking about this issue of control over independent productions, this idea of compliance is going to be key in the inquiry that the BBC is still carrying out into what happened.
Yes, Mark Thompson, I think it's almost a year now since they introduced new compliance procedures. And Thompson was very keen to say yesterday that it wasn't a failure of the systems, it was a failure of a judgment and the people who were making those judgments. And he laid the responsibility very much at the door of producers and executive producers and controllers, not presenters, which is another thing that got Gambaccini's goat. And you wonder if anyone within the BBC had actually seen it within the BBC had actually heard the broadcast in the week after it went out and before the Mail on Sunday splashed on it, and if they did know about it, why it wasn't action taken then and nipped it in the bud.
The role of Leslie Douglas in this is absolutely gripping to me, in that she wasn't there, she didn't produce the show. We've got a 25-year-old producer who clearly is not in a position to say to Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand...
Russell Brand's who employs him.
Who employs him. Oh, I think that was a bit near the knuckle, we really shouldn't do that. So we've got... And then you've got a sort of equally junior chain of command going up to Leslie Douglas, who, by all accounts, is very, very close to her talent. They all adore her and has previously probably, backed the talent over a producer's judgment that's not out of the bounds of possibility. Who does Leslie go to for guidance, exactly? Yeah. There is nobody. Jenny Abramsky figure, gone.
Well, I was going to say...
Just no one there.
I think it would.
Storming down to John Burt's office and ripped him.
No, somebody... my husband, who used to work at the BBC many years ago, said to me, oh God, I wouldn't like to have done that on Jenny Abramsky's watch. Just that sort of it would have happened, but you would have lived with this visceral fear of her coming round and, really sort of tearing you into tiny pieces.
Both barrels.
But also, Jenny Abramsky could look Leslie Douglas in the eye, maybe she's sort of standing on a box, but she could have looked her in the eye and said, I'm going to give you all this creative freedom, Leslie, don't mess it up.
And but the trouble is that the BBC Trust didn't seem to take the same view, did they? Because in their statement this week, they said specifically that there were inadequate controls in non-news programming on BBC Radio, and that all needs to be tightened up.
Yeah, which suggests to me that there was some strongly worded and some heated debates going on yesterday, which suggests that why the meeting went on for 3.5 hours and possibly could have gone on for much longer.
John, is it too early to start speculating on who might succeed Leslie Douglas?
Well, I think there are a couple of names in the frame. One of them is Bob Shannon, who's the former controller of BBC Radio 5 Live and head of TV Sport, who, as you know, left the corporation last year to go to 4 Digital.
An organisation, an outfit, which collapsed in rather ignominious circumstances a few weeks ago, leaving him looking for a job.
Plenty of time on his hands.
Absolutely.
And I think he's a safe pair of hands, which is exactly what Radio 2 needs at the moment after the trauma of the last couple of weeks.
Mm, absolutely. Anyone else in the frame?
And another person, it could be Andy Parfitt, who's controller of BBC Radio 1. He's been in the job now for I think the best part of a decade, and so he's 50, so he's in the kind of used to be the Radio 2 demographic. Now he's probably a bit too old for Radio 2 as he certainly is for Radio 1.
But that would be very interesting because he transformed Radio 1 into made a transformation similar to what Leslie Douglas was doing at Radio 2 for Radio 1, didn't he?
That's right, yes. He's overseen a tweak and an evolution of its programming to the station that it is today. And I think, like Shannon, he'd be another safe pair of hands. Mm. I think what we'll definitely see is possibly a retrenchment away from some of the more cutting-edge programming that Douglas has introduced over the last couple of years, and maybe a retrenchment towards sort of almost a bit more old-school style Radio 2, but hopefully not boring Radio 2.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We'll keep up to date with the race to succeed Leslie Douglas as the controller of Radio 2 on mediaguardian.co.uk. We can be sure that you'll be on the case, John.
I certainly will, man.
All right. Thanks, John Plunkett. Thanks very much. Let's broaden this out now, finally. What does this whole sorry affair tell us about the shifting cultural sands? Are we entering a new era of morality, the terms of which will be dictated by Melanie Phillips and the Daily Mail? Or is there a broader movement against the sort of comedy epitomised particularly by Jonathan Ross? John Harris is a Guardian columnist and esteemed cultural commentator. I asked him if it was possible, as lefty Guardianistas, to feel uncomfortable about this whole affair without subscribing to the Daily Mail moral outrage agenda.
It certainly was on Sunday and Monday and a bit of Tuesday. I feel a little less certain now about making loud noise about this, just because the whole thing has got so mad now in cant and stupidity and Georgina Bailey selling her story to the Sun and what have you. But the reason that I took offence, if that's the right phrase, at this broadcast was for sort of fundamentally lefty, liberal, progressive reasons. You know, it pointed up a style of broadcasting which I think is cruel, bullying, and tends to treat largely innocent people as means for other people's entertainment, which strikes me as a sort of pretty nasty version of right-wing individualism. I mean, that's not a reflection of Brandon Ross's politics necessarily, but I think it's symptomatic of something very deep-seated in society, which I think lefties have every reason to take objection to.
And when did all this start to happen?
There's a question. Thatcher. No, I mean, obviously the answer's not as crass as that, but there's something to be said for the idea that in the course of the 1980s, Britain and large parts of the industrial world became much more materialistic and acquisitive and atomised. And as a result of that, ideas like mutual respect and care and consideration and community and all that definitely started to get corroded. I don't think this is that characterises the whole of society by any means, but I think you end up with, at the sort of grassroots level, a phenomenon like happy slapping. And in media outlets and so on, you get presenters like, say, Chris Moyles, whose personal broadcasting style, it strikes me, is very often based on being boorish and nasty and somewhat cruel to people.
You mentioned Chris Moyles and Radio 1, which he's the flagship presenter on. 60% of Radio 1 listeners thought this was all fine. Is it a generational
thing?
That's
a really interesting question, and I find it quite disquieting. Having said that, that's based on young people's kind of snap responses to all this. And I think if you put a microphone in front of people, you're either going to get one or two things. One is, ooh, it's a storm in a teacup, or the other one is, ooh, it's disgusting. It's not much more nuanced than that. And I think on either side of it, if people thought a little bit more about it, were given time, you'd probably get something a bit more nuanced. But maybe it's a generational difference, but I think it's a bit more serious than that.
Do you think it's a good thing that this has all been raised, and perhaps we can have a sensible debate about all of this now? I don't know if
Yeah, I mean, it felt like that on Monday. I mean, when I wrote that piece on Monday, which appeared in the Guardian's comment section in the print edition on Tuesday, I would say most of all the emails I got, of which I got quite a number, and probably about two-thirds or three-quarters of the responses on comment is free, were supportive of what I'd written for the reasons that it seemed to say something about an argument that needed to be had. So I think that's definitely true. I mean, I've thought this for a long while. To reduce it to a simple phrase, I just think there's not enough generosity of spirit around in the society in which we live and the media, which sort of essays that society. And I think that's something we have to talk about. The problem is you can't talk about it when Max Clifford's got involved and the Daily Mail is in full cry and, you know, everything, as I say, and, you know, the Prime Minister's piped up about it and all the rest of it. It's very difficult because all I hear now, like most people, is just noise. It's like white noise.
And it's hard to get involved in this debate without sounding like you're a sort of paid-up member of the Mary Whitehouse Brigade, doesn't
it? Yeah, but I think we have to drop that now. Yeah. I mean, I did say this in the piece that I wrote. I think lefty liberal people, for want of a better word, are often wary of going into these arguments, A, because the ghost of Mary Whitehouse is still hanging around, and B, because you have people like Melanie Phillips at the Daily Mail who will sound off at the drop of a hat about this stuff. But, you know, when I hear someone like George Lamb on Six Music interview Ray Davis from the Kinks, he finished interviewing him, apparently, having asked him if he was bald, point blank, which is no way to talk to anybody, he then accused Ray Davis of being senile on the air. You know, I just think there's too much of this stuff around. There's actually more of it on Channel 4. But I think perhaps the time has come to say, that's enough. You know, you can entertain people and you can pull in a younger audience without having to resort to cruelty and nastiness.
Janine, do you feel uncomfortable about expressing outrage about this in the same breath as Melanie Phillips?
No, I don't feel comfortable expressing outrage about anything generally as a rule. I think there. I did speak to somebody, a senior television executive, a couple of days ago, who was shouting at me, "We're letting the Daily Mail run everything. We can't let them win. They're always going to win. And when will it end if we always let them win?" And I think the answer to that is to take a step back, take a deep breath, and issue a proportional response. You've got to acknowledge where they're right as well as where they're really, really wrong.
Do you think? You look very depressed at this point.
I'm not. It was completely wrong, and somebody, as I say, should have been punished. But I'm so far from being outraged by this. It's such an overused term. You know, there are so many. This is where I get sort of slightly boring and serious. Actually, I'm boring most of the time, but. There are so many things to be genuinely outraged by, and I do think it's, you know, utterly, utterly woeful that the Daily Mail and its hideous brand of moral conservatism, which frightens and intimidates people on a daily basis and legitimises that, it should have any part of kind of dictating the editorial policy of the BBC. I think I am really depressed by it, actually.
That's all true, Emily, except that something went out and it wasn't, you know, it was broadcast.
It was a mistake. Shouldn't have gone.
Yeah, absolutely. And nobody noticed, really. There were two complaints, as the BBC constantly tells us, until the Daily Mail made a fuss about it. Mail on Sunday made a fuss about it.
Which was an echo.
I'm not saying thanks to the Mail on Sunday for their public service dedication.
No, it's an echo chamber of vested interests. And actually, I feel really sad that the BBC couldn't stand up to that.
But you want a world in which the press is allowed to scrutinise and monitor. And maybe, you know, we happen to not agree with the Daily Mail's attempt at monitoring and scrutinising.
No, I mean, I'm not saying they should, you know, there isn't balancing.
They are actually performing their job for their audience, depressing as it is.
Thanks very much to the Daily Mail. Well,
I didn't say that.
Marvellous. I think we have now covered all the angles. Do we agree that...
No, you are kidding. You are kidding. We've got a whole other report coming out in an hour. We'll have to do an update at 3 o'clock.
All right, listen, I think we've covered all the angles for now. Now, one of our other podcasts this week mentioned that an interview with Wall Street Journal tech blogger Kara Swisher would be appearing on this week's Media Talk. Not likely. Unfortunately,
what does she think about Russell Brand?
I don't know. She hasn't got any views on Russell Brand, sadly, so that's why she's not here.
She'll
be explaining how hard it was to get the journal up to take up blogging next week instead. Now, that's it for Media Talk for this week. Well, for today anyway. We'll see what happens later. Comment on any part of the programme on our website at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. I'm Matt Wells. There'll be more next week. Bye.
Hello. Please leave your message after the tone.